All right. Good morning, everybody. We're going to get started. Thanks for your patience. We'll convene the Liquor and Cannabis Board Caucus meeting for November 8th, 2022. Today, we're going to spend our time on the second of a three-part series of meetings we're having, commemorating, acknowledging, exploring the 10-year anniversary of the legalization of cannabis in Washington State. It was passed by voters in 2012. By the way, happy election day. If you haven't voted, go do that. Today, we're going to have the chance to hear from two prominent researchers who are going to share with us what they've learned from results of some really interesting and in-depth studies and work on the impact of cannabis policies implemented in the regulated market over the past 10 years, as well as impacts on the broader population since the legalization of a regulated adult use market. And to introduce our guests, I will turn it over to our public health and education liaison, Mary Sagala. Go ahead, Mary. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Postman and Board Member Vollendorf. Thank you for the opportunity to bring these two researchers to you today. David Hammond is a professor and university research chair in public health in the School of Public Health Sciences at the University of Waterloo. Dr. Hammond's research focuses on population level interventions to reduce chronic disease, primarily in the areas of tobacco control, obesity prevention, and substance use policy. He is the principal researcher for the International Cannabis Policy Study, and today he'll share with us Washington data from this research. Julia Dilley, our second speaker, is a senior research scientist and epidemiologist with Multnomah County Health Department and State of Oregon Public Health Division. Her current research focuses on public health effects of law and policy around cannabis, alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. She's the principal investigator for a 9-year federally funded research study of cannabis legalization impacts in Washington and Oregon. Since 2016, Dr. Dilley has co-chaired the Nationwide Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists Cannabis Subcommittee, leading efforts to identify the best measures and methods for cannabis-related public health monitoring. She will be sharing with us Washington-specific public health data. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Hammond.
Thanks very much, Mary. I'll just get things going at this end here. Okay. Can I just confirm that you can see the slides, Mary?
Yes.
Great. Okay, thanks. Look, I just want to, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm from Canada. We, as you all know, legalized non-medical cannabis in 2018. And so a lot of the questions about evaluation and market trends are similar to what we have up here. And just before I begin, I have no commercial or industry associations to declare. I'm a professor and I do not-for-profit research. And very briefly, I just want to point out that the work I'm going to share with you today is not just about understanding what the overall impact of legalization might be, but to try and understand some of the policies and regulations that are implemented in a legal market. I always point out that tobacco cigarettes have been, they've always been legal, but the way we regulate them today is much different than 50 or 100 years ago. And so hopefully we can learn how best to regulate cannabis in the public interest over a much sooner timeline. And of course, there are many questions about, you know, what's the right retail density? Should we have standards for products? What's the best labeling or restrictions on advertising or promotion? And those are the sorts of things that we're trying to, the questions that we're asking in our work. And just at a couple spots today, I'll drop in a bit of data from Canada, because in the same way that different states have taken different approaches, Canada has taken a different approach than all the other states, and it gives us a chance to look at some alternative policies and regulations. So I'm just going to give a 30-second summary of what it is that I'm presenting to you today. It has the grandiose title of International Cannabis Policy Study. Why do we do this? We do it because we need more detailed data than many of the national surveys or state surveys even provide. We need data on what I call policy-specific measures, and we need that data over time, asked in the same way across different jurisdictions. And so essentially what I'm showing you are data from national surveys, annual surveys. We do them with ages 16 to 65, so we don't have older adults here. And we've done it with about 170,000 people over 4 years, including the US. And as I said, we do the same surveys with the same methods in different countries so we can compare. So I'm happy to answer any technical questions. But we've been doing it in Washington State with just over 7,000 people. And we've been doing this anyway. Washington State has provided a bit of extra funding to try and boost some samples. And we have been producing reports for Mary and others at your end. And so it's a real pleasure to share some of this data with you today. And as I said, what we do is we collect lots of data on consumption, different product modes, different indicators of problematic use, things that we'd rather not see from a public health perspective. And some of these policy-specific measures, like how, you know, are people seeing advertising promotion? How much are they paying? Where are they buying their cannabis? Can we estimate the size of the illicit market, et cetera? And in some cases, we compare that with the differences in laws and regulations across states. So does it matter if some states have more restrictive retail policies, if some allow more advertising than others? Okay, that's my introduction. And by the way, I can't see any hands, but I'm delighted if people want to speak up and interrupt me and ask for more detail or anything like that. So please do interrupt me. So let me start by just showing you a little bit of our data about how things have changed. And again, we've been doing this annual surveys over the last 4 years. And I just want to, off the top, say that because of our age range, you'll look at some of these numbers and prevalence and say, boy, that's high. And part of it is because we've actually concentrated our surveys among the ages where cannabis use is most prevalent. We also have higher prevalence in those age groups, which in some ways is a bit of a bonus when we're trying to look at consumer trends. But overall, our trends over time are very similar than I think that what Julia is going to show you, for example, which is to say modest increases, fairly stable over the past 4 years. Obviously some pandemic effects in there. But one of the things we certainly ask in our sample is how many consumers identify as a medical user. And so we find that about 25% of past 12-month consumers in Washington State say, yeah, I self-identify primarily as a medical cannabis user. And you can see that that's a little bit lower than the US average. And in a lot of these slides, I'm going to be showing you data for Washington compared to the overall national average we see, that's US. And then I've also broken out states by their sort of legal status. And apologies for the crude abbreviation, but illegal, medical, and legal states. So you can see that about that consumers in Washington are a little less likely than some other states to self-identify as a medical marijuana user. And about 1 out of 10, 9%, tell us that, they've received authorization. They have current authorization in the past 12 months as a medical cannabis user. So again, that's lower than what we see in some other states, but it's actually typical for some of the more mature or established legal markets. Now, of course, we're not just interested in whether people are using cannabis, we're interested in what they're using. And what we've seen in Washington State is similar to what we've seen overall in the U.S. Now, overall in the U.S., we've seen a little bit more of a decrease in dried flower. So this is among people that use cannabis, which products have they used in the past year? In most states, we've actually seen dried flower decrease a little bit more. The difference, of course, is that Washington for us is a more mature market, and so they've maybe seen some of that decline. But what you really see, and this is true across most jurisdictions, is large increases, even in the last 4 years, in the number of consumers that are using edibles. We see vape oils. Most of you will remember EVALI. That was a serious lung disease epidemic in 2019, which kind of took the wind out of the sails. But in most places, we've seen vape oils sort of recover from that. And you can see most other forms, whether it's oral oils or topicals or hash, they've all been increasing. So we've seen sort of stable or a bit of a decrease in most places in dried flower, but an increase in most other forms, many of which have higher, more concentrated THC levels. So that's a snapshot.
Could I ask you a quick question there on the edibles piece? Any sense of a breakdown of that, what I read in the trades is, sorry, gummies are all the rage. Do you have a sense of how much of that would be candy versus others?
We do. We ask, we have about 6 or 8 different categories. Unfortunately, I don't have that for you here, but I'll follow up with Mary and make sure that you get that.
Great, thanks.
Yep. And here's one of the takeaways. You know, we sometimes talk about these products as very distinct categories and wonder if a user of one is different than a user of another. The bottom line here is that most consumers are using more than one product. So of all the folks in our study who use cannabis in the past year, only 25% said, oh yeah, I've only used one product. Most of them use 2, 3, 4, 5 products. And so we have this really flexible sort of poly use. And I think that's important to recognize that consumers aren't really siloed necessarily in the types of products they use. And this is the only slide where I'm going to show you data from some of our other countries. But what you see is that this idea of poly use is much more common in the US than these other countries. New Zealand, Australia, you might know, have very restrictive medical cannabis access. But this is something that we're seeing with sort of, again, legal markets, more manufacturing, processing of different products, is that it's not just that people are using other products, they're using multiple products often over, you know, the course of a day or a week or a month. Now, I was asked to just, you know, put a few slides in about the impact of COVID-19. And so we ask folks, you know, we can look at the trends and prevalence, but we ask them directly, hey, how did the pandemic affect how much you used? And you can see that, you know, about 7 out of 10 say it didn't have any impact. A small number say they stopped. A little bit higher number, 4%, say they started using because of the pandemic. But more commonly, people said, I used a bit less, or the most common answer was, I used a bit more. And by the way, this is what we've seen in Canada. We've seen this in other national surveys. So it wasn't so much that people started or stopped being a consumer. It's that some used it a little less. More commonly, people, you know, they were home more, they weren't at work. And so they, if they used, many of them consumed more. And of course, one of the questions is how these trends in Washington compare to other jurisdictions. And so again, I'm just going to roll through a couple of these product categories very quickly. And the short answer is these are all 2021 data, but we used to see more differences between states that where, you know, cannabis is still prohibited versus medical and legal. You can see that those differences have largely narrowed for things like dried flower. You can see that Washington state a little bit higher, but compared to those other US legal states, which is the far right, pretty similar for things like edibles. Same thing for vape oils. We used to see more of a difference. Now we're seeing very uniform use across the different categories. Solid concentrates, wax, shatter, things like that, you can see is a little bit higher in Washington state, 33% compared to an average of about 27% in US legal states. And one area where we still, where actually we see Washington is a fair bit higher is cannabis beverages. And I think that's because this is a product that is most closely associated with the illicit market. You don't see much of it on the illegal market. Pardon me, I said that the other way around. You don't see many beverages on the illegal market. It requires a bit more manufacturing and storage and things. And so, again, it's something we see that's higher among the more mature legal markets. I just want to pick out a couple of trends that we've seen recently. So, you know, flower is either sort of stayed the same or decreased a little bit, but where it's grown is in the type of flower product. So I'm sure you see this in your sales data, but we see that of people who dry flower, but who tell us that they bought flower, about a third say, yeah, last purchase, I bought pre-rolls. So in Canada, in some other US legal states, we're seeing less sort of loose flower and more processed in terms of pre-rolls, especially in the adult legal market. And we're seeing that more of those pre-rolls are infused. Call it what you want. Some people call moon rockets or whatever. But this is dipped, or it's got bits of solid concentrates. These are, you know, high 30s, 40%. We're starting to see that idea of processing, manufacturing, that trend is happening even within the category of dried flower, and we're seeing more potent products out there as a result. And again, this aligns very well with what we're seeing with sales data in different jurisdictions. Lots of CBD use.
Yes. I have a quick question. Going back to this one, so 25%, when did we start tracking the sale of infused products? So what was it before it was 25%? And are you still tracking that so we can watch that trend?
We just started doing a better job of that in 2021. I'll tell you why. because we were trying to figure out why people were paying so much money for some of these pre-rolls. These are premium price products. And I don't know how your sales reporting works in Washington State. I've seen some differences in how mandatory reporting, whether they break these out or not. But they are, I would say, a kind of a distinct class. I think they're growing. So we'll have data for you. We've already collected it, but for 2022, and we're going to be doing even more detail on it moving forward because it's a qualitatively different product, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. I was just about to say it. Lots of CBD products. Consumers have a very hard time reporting what is a THC or non-THC or CBD product. The profile looks different, oils, topicals, things like that. But this has obviously been a big trend. One of the other things we've tried to track is Delta 8 THC products, which a lot of you will be familiar with. And I'm going to skip to the punchline here, which is we have 3% of all of our respondents telling us that they've ever used a Delta 8 THC product. I don't have the time to get into it today, but that is certainly going to be subject to over-reporting, because we actually asked it in kind of a creative way where we asked about Delta 4, Delta 10, Delta 9, and you can see lots of folks are confused. And so I think there's some over-reporting here, but we'll be able to track it, what that looks like over time. All right, let me transition to talking a little bit about where people are purchasing their products. So we ask this several different ways. One way is just to look at where we say, you know, which sources in the past 12 months have you got cannabis from? And this is the Washington State data. And that yellow line is from a store. The orange line is a family, friend, or social source. Gray line is dealer. Blue line is made or grew their own. And you can see that, look, again, Washington, it's not like you're a year or two into this here. So you've got fairly stable trends. The change that we see in that orange line is probably pandemic related. You can see a resumption to trend in 2021. And, you know, dealers somewhere 22 down to 17% by 2021. We recently published a paper on home grow to look at just, as you know, some states permit it, some states don't. Legal states, I should say, and there's different limits on the number of plants. So I've got more detail. But, you know, it's interesting to ask, are people more likely to home grow in a legal market because it's legal? Or are they more likely to do it in an illegal market because you don't have to, you know, enter into transactions with dealers? And the answer is it's a touch higher in legal states than not. And this just gives you an example of the breakdown that I was just showing you. Washington State, even among legal states, has a very high proportion of people buying from stores, lower from social sources, much lower even than other legal states for dealers, 17% in Washington State versus 29% in other legal states. And you can see home grows a touch lower in Washington than some of the other legal states. Now, of course, people are interested in, well, okay, but some of those sources could be legal or illegal. I'm going to say illicit just because it's easier to distinguish when I'm talking. What we ask this a number of different ways. So we infer it from where they've purchased it. We also ask people straight up, was your last purchase from a legal or illicit store? We ask people, hey, of all the products you've bought, what percentage are illegal or legal? And is there some misreporting here? Absolutely there is. But what we've seen in places like Canada, where we've tracked it from the start, is that it does align fairly well with changes in the actual legal retail sales data. So what do we see when we ask people, hey, look, just in a crude sense, what percentage of all products that you've purchased come from a legal store? Washington State is as high as we've seen in any legal state. So it's, you can see it's bang on about 90%. That's all, you know, it's not to say it's universal, but that's very high for this type of thing, even higher than the other legal states as I'm showing here on the screen. I did want to make one other point, and that point was we also asked this for separate product categories. And I'm not going to show it to you today, but I can tell you that, for example, it's much lower. This percentage is much lower for solid concentrates. It's higher for things like cannabis beverages. So I think we do need to get past just thinking about dried flower. And we need to think about why some people are buying some of these products from a legal source more so than illegal. Okay, one of the questions asked about pandemic is we're just interested, would it help or hurt the shift to legal stores, you can see that people are telling us that during the pandemic, it made them more likely to buy in a legal store. We don't necessarily see any big changes in the overall estimates I just showed you, but that's at least people's impression that it probably helped more than hindered in terms of encouraging legal sales. Okay, price is obviously very important. It's important from a tax revenue. It's important because it's probably tied to consumption at some level. And so we get people to self-report price. Now, if you have the actual price of legal retail sales, that is obviously, you know, the best if you have that census data. But we work really hard to try and get as much detail as we can. And I'm showing you the sales weighted price per gram of dried flour at last purchase. And our studies tell us that people are reporting a lower price per gram in Washington State, $7.38. You can see that that's compared to just over $9 overall in the US. And it's about a dollar and a half less than we see in some other legal states. And by the way, you all know this, but some of those other US legal states are newly, you know, they're brand new fresh markets. So we have breakdowns compared to Washington, Colorado, and Alaska, and some of the other more mature markets, if you're interested.
And have you found, Doctor, that as the market matures, that price decreases? Have we seen
yes.
that in Colorado, California?
Yes. Yeah, we do. And there are some exceptions. And let me see. I'm sorry, I don't break it out for you today, but I sometimes have a slide of the different legal states. So Oregon has the lowest price, regardless. So I'm probably misremembering, but you know, a lot of that decline happens in the first 5 years. In Canada, we've seen like a halving of the price. It's remarkable. We're now down to, you can buy less than $3 a gram in Canada. It's remarkable. We started at about $10 to $12. Yes.
Is that just as people get used to a legal market and they feel more comfortable and there's more people who buying? Is that what drives it? What's happening?
It's absolutely true. We're lucky because we got out before Canada legalized that. Yeah, the transition to legal sources has been almost linear. And we're now, you know, the estimate 73/4 of the market is now legal in Canada after 4 years. But it's competition. We've had we have far fewer opt-outs in terms of, you know, what do you call them, counties that might opt out. We have legal online sales in all of Canada. And so it's pure competition is what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you have any thoughts about the future of the prices? What are your thoughts? What's the industry looking at in the future?
Well, the industry's lobbying very hard to reduce the level of tax, which is about $1 a gram for flour. Plus, interestingly, you may know that our provinces are the distributors in every case. So the government, in some cases, their government runs stores. So the industry solution is to try and reduce the tax, but I suspect there's still going to be the vigorous competition, whether the tax is reduced or not. So, well, we're seeing a lot of contraction in the industry, but the big companies are having a very hard time getting market share because of our very strict advertising and promotion regulations. I will say something about that in a minute. Oh, go ahead.
When you say competition, does it mean the same, or is it a different conversation on where we hear there's oversupply?
Well, I think you have a bit of a different. Oh, so there was some oversupply for sure. I think there's a bit of a different situation in the U.S. where oversupply in a legal state raises the likelihood of diversion to other states. Because we have federal legalization, we don't have that same concern or issue, but certainly the industry ramped up in terms of their manufacturing, but even in terms of stores. I have a lovely picture of a store in my hometown which has a grand opening balloons and then sorry we're closed sign. Like, I mean, it's been so volatile. The government in some places restricts the retail stores and some it's just kind of free market, and so the government, they've just overshot, frankly. Okay, I'm going to push on, but happy to answer more questions. So what I was about to say is, you know, a key question is, what's the price differential between legal and illicit sources? Well, because we ask price at last purchase, because we try and figure out if the last purchase was legal or not based on what they tell us, here's what I'm showing you for Washington State over time. And that dark line is all sources. The light green line is when they tell us they bought it from a legal source, and the red is illegal. Now, before anyone gets too excited about that red line going way up, that little gray line is an error bar. Because we have relatively few people purchasing from an illegal source, that's subject to a fair amount of variation. But what we're seeing in Washington is what we've seen in Colorado and a couple of the older states, which is in most places, the illicit price reported to us is lower. It remains lower than the legal price. But in some of the oldest markets, it's a little higher, which is very interesting to me. And it suggests that, you know, you have to ask, in such a mature market, why are people still going to the illicit source? Well, maybe they're below the minimum legal age. Maybe they live in a jurisdiction with no stores, in which case there's actually a price premium. So I think what is a good takeaway is that the legal sales price is competing very effectively with the illicit sales price in the most mature markets like Washington State. Okay. You know, we're interested in why people. Yes, please.
Quick question on the illegal and with the price being higher. Is there anything determining the age of the ones that's buying it illegal? Is it the folks underage that can't get into the legal stores? Is there any?
Yeah. That's a great question. And, you know, we have the ability to answer it. We just haven't looked at it. But I think you're absolutely right. And I have a couple kids in high school. And look, of course, it's not my kids. But if kids are buying a joint, they're going to pay a premium for it. You know, they might pay $10 a joint or $20 a joint because, you know, it's harder for them to access. So I think that is probably what's driving it. It's a great question. And that's something that we certainly can look at. Yeah. Thank you. Very briefly, so, you know, why do people, you know, what's the basis for choosing to buy from an illegal or illicit source? What I'm showing on the screen here is we say, hey, look, compared to illegal cannabis, is legal cannabis blank? Now, they can say more or less expensive. I've just sort of summarized it for you here, but you can see that about a third of all consumers in Washington State think that legal cannabis is more expensive. Most actually think it's less expensive. You can see that all the other reasons are quite low. So only about 1 in 10 feel that legal cannabis is lower quality, and you know, a negligible amount see an advantage for illicit cannabis in terms of safety or convenience. I could have flipped this around and showed you positive attitudes towards legal cannabis, but the bottom line is that price is the thing that some consumers, it's the main reason that some consumers are giving. And I won't go into this. You're welcome to have the slides, of course, but this slide shows you of those who tell us that they've bought illegally. Last slide was everybody, what do you think? This one is, okay, you've bought illegally. Now tell us why. What were the reasons why? And there's a smattering of different reasons. You see prices. You see convenience. Probably depends on where you live. Anonymity. I didn't want to show ID. Loyalty to my dealer. So there's a range of different reasons here. There's no one dominant reason, but certainly price remains up there. Okay, I'm working towards the end. I'm conscious of time, and I'm happy to chat and answer more questions if you'd like. I just wanted to show you two kind of other sort of policy relevant things, and one of them is health warnings and labeling. Now, we've been doing lots of work about labeling of 10 or 5 milligram servings for edibles and what people understand. I'm not going to show you that today. I will make the point that we see very, very low levels of what I call THC literacy. Very few consumers know the typical THC amounts of their products. Most get confused and give us milligrams when they should be telling percent. They give us numbers that don't exist. For example, when we ask about dried flower, 75% right off the top say, I don't know what the THC levels are typically. They'll tell you it's sativa or indica or something. And then those that think they know, the 25% that think they know, about half of them give us a number that doesn't exist. What I'm showing you here is health warnings on cannabis products. And I know Washington has, you know, different universal symbols and things, but we ask people, hey, look, you know, have you seen a health warning on a cannabis product recently? And what we see is that Washington consumers are more likely than consumers in other jurisdictions to say, yeah, I see the warnings for cannabis products. It's about 25% of everyone we ask. Now, you might be like, why are you asking that of a non-consumer? I can tell you that when you have a big enough warning, you don't have to be a consumer to see it. It might be sitting on the ground. It might be a friend or something. When you sort of drill down and just look at those that have consumed in the past 12 months, it's about 41%. So, you know, it's glass half full, half empty. That means that, look, that mandated information you have is reaching a lot of people. It's not reaching everybody. And there's a lot of consumers that report not even seeing it at all. But, you know, you're doing better than other jurisdictions as far as we can tell. We've done lots of research on this. We've done little experiments and things. And what I will say is, look, I spent more of my career demonstrating the obvious that the bigger you make a warning, the more understandable you make it, the more people use it and pay attention to it. It's true of tobacco, it's true of food, and it's true of cannabis. You might know that Canada has much more comprehensive warnings than any U.S. state. And in little experiments and things like that, we have shown that those warnings are actually most effective relative to those in any of the U.S. states. Okay, last section here, just a little bit about advertising and promotion. You know, this is a concern a lot of folks have with the legal market. The concern, of course, is that it reaches young people, and we have lots of evidence from other areas, whether it's e-cigarettes or tobacco or alcohol, that, you know, seeing promotions is an important risk factor for young people. So I'm going to show you, first of all, where people tell us they see ads. So this is, we say, hey, where have you seen ads or promotions in the past 12 months? And the most common locations that we see in Washington State are billboards and posters, outside stores, inside stores, and then you have your two digital. And I can tell you that a lot of folks don't think about stores being an important source of promotion in their own right, but they are, including among non-consumers. And this is the biggest difference we see between illegal and legal states. It's the stores and billboards, whereas we see fewer differences for social media and digital sources. Why? Because, of course, that, you know, crosses borders. So this is just a summary of whether people report noticing any ads or promotions. You can see Washington State is higher. Now, again, that's partly because it's an established market, but it's a little higher than even the U.S. legal states. And so, you know, food for thought. I will point out that in Canada, you might know, we have very strict rules. Very little advertising and promotion is permitted. The industry, it's in their sights. They don't like it at all. But one of the things we've done, and we've updated this, I'm showing you a bit of a dated one, but we've looked at Canada, we've looked at some of the early legal states, and we've gone through all your regulatory documents and just tried to code it and say, look, how strong are the restrictions? And Canada, which is that column with all the red boxes, it comes out on top. Much stricter rules than any other state. According to our own work, we have Washington State down among this, you know, somewhat less restrictive of the initial states. And what we've done is we've taken that data I show you from the surveys and said, hey, does it actually line up? So forget legal, illegal. Let's look at the different legal markets and see, does the strength of the rules reflect this, how much people are seeing? So these are the same numbers I just showed you. And I'm embarrassed to tell you how long it took me to make this slide move. But you have these little blue dots, that's each state, and you have Canada on the far right. So this is how strict the rules are, with stricter rules to the right. And then we line that up with what we're seeing from our surveys and how much advertising they're seeing. And we do see a really consistent, strong correlation where, you know, there's Washington State. The looser the rules, the more people see. And generally speaking, younger people report seeing as much or more advertising than other consumers. So this isn't rocket science, but, you know, it is evidence that the strength of the rules matter, and we can look and see whether it changes attitudes or intentions or susceptibility. Last two slides, and then I'll be quiet. What about social norms? You know, we ask a classic question about whether people think that society approves or disapproves of marijuana. And you can see Washington State is bang on average. In fact, you know, this is news to some folks, not to others, but actually similar levels of approval regardless of the legal status of cannabis. I think that's an important thing to remember. And this is the same thing broken out by age. The youngest respondents are green and orange. And I have to say, this looks a little different than some other states. In most states, the youngest people are right at the top. But in Washington State, they're a little bit lower. So that's that, again, that green line. But very stable over the past 4 years in terms of, you know, some little bumps up and down, but nothing too major. And finally, from our surveys, how many respondents in Washington believe that recreational and non-medical marijuana should be legal? Well, it's up to 70% by our survey in 2021. You can see that that's been a very steady increase. We've seen decreases in folks that think that recreational marijuana should be illegal. Certain amounts, they sort of don't know neutral. And when you compare that with other jurisdictions, you see that Washington is among the highest. And I will say that we've seen a trend in the legal state. Well, look, it's gone up everywhere, support for legalization. It goes up after states legalize. So we've seen a similar pattern that I showed you for Washington and some of the other legal states. And that also explains why it's even higher in Washington, given that you've got a longer history. So I will be quiet. I will say that Mary has a report with many of these indicators that we prepare for your state. We also have a national report in case you're interested in more of these comparisons, and we have one for Canada as well. And that's on our website, cannabisproject.ca, but I'm happy to share that with folks or answer any questions you have. So thanks to our wonderful group, and if there's time, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Let me just check in with Mary real quick. Mary, should we hear from Dr. Dilley and then come back to ask questions of both guests? Is that the plan here?
I think it's, you know, if you have something burning right now, I think you can ask. We are a couple minutes ahead of schedule.
Oh, great.
But then we can switch to Julia shortly.
Okay, well then, I always have something burning. So let me ask you one quick one. You were talking about the warning labels, and clearly, you know, the bigger that is, the more effective it is. What does effective mean, though? Does that mean
That's
people don't
question.
Use it, or do they use it responsibly?
That's a great question. Look, you know, when you're evaluating warning labels, you start with noticing. If you don't see it, you can't use it. So we look at noticing, and then we ask people, can you tell us what messages are on packages? So that's a good objective measure of recall. Bottom line is there are different states with different messages. If the message is on the warning label, folks in that state are more likely to remember it than states where it's not on there. And then you can look at sort of health knowledge. How does it inform like what they believe the risks might be? So you might have a warning on impaired driving or use during pregnancy or whatever. You can stretch out beyond that to like, well, how might that affect patterns of use? That's a bit of a trickier methodological issue, but we typically spend our time at the front end saying, do they notice it? Can they remember it? And is it associated with health knowledge? And generally speaking, you see that to be the case. Of course, it's not a magic bullet, but it also reflects just the proportion of a legal market. You're sourcing from an illicit source, you ain't seeing those warnings. Interestingly, we see people in illegal states that are getting products from California or whatever, and so they're seeing like the California warnings or whatever. So I suppose that's a positive example of diversion, but not the plan, I suppose.
Yeah, thank you. Other questions now, Dr. Hammond, before we move on? Jim, Ollie? No? Okay, great. Stand by if you can, and I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Dilley. Thank you.
Okay, that's doing anything.
We've got your slides. We can see those.
Okay, so you're okay, great. Well, yes. Thank you. So I'm always tickled to present with Dr. Hammond, and you know, he just presented to you findings from Washington State from an international study where Washington's in the context of all kinds of other states and Canada as well. Now I'm going to talk with you about some findings we've seen from our research in Washington that uses Washington home grow data, so to speak, and kind of what we've seen from within the state in the past 10 years. And I want to acknowledge, of course,
Excuse me, Julia, do you want to move it into presentation mode?
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, there we go.
Great, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Yeah, and just I want to give a big thanks to, as Mary mentioned, we have a National Institute on Drug Abuse from the NIH research study going on to study the impacts of cannabis legalization in Washington and Oregon, and also many collaborators across Washington agencies and Oregon agencies, including Mary and others at the LCB. So I'll just quickly go over today, what have we seen in the past 10 years since Initiative 502 in Washington State, focusing on sort of three topics. One is positive regulatory approaches within Washington State. Second is trends and product use among adults and youth within the state. And then third, just touching briefly on some public health outcomes. So I wanted to start by saying that I think Washington kind of uniquely approached cannabis legalization with a strong public health and safety lens. And one of the basic regulatory framework elements that Washington applied that you all are very well aware of is the cap on the number of cannabis retail licensees allowed to operate in the state and then within geographic areas too. So on the left side, what you're seeing is the number of cannabis retail licensees that were making sales, so not just awarded a license, but actually making sales per month over time from when the market opened in July of 2014 up through May of 2022. The numbers you can see on the screen are the numbers that were active during December of each calendar year. And what you can see is that the number of retailers increased over the first 4 years or so, and then it's been holding steady. And that's because the number of maximum licenses that are allowed to be distributed have been distributed. But what this cap plays out, what this cap means in terms of relative public health and safety effects relative to other states can be seen on the right. So those multicolored bar charts are showing you the per capita number of cannabis licensees in the first four legalized states in December of 2019. And what you can see there is that Washington has a lower per capita cannabis retail licensee number, you know, compared to Alaska, Colorado, and Oregon. So that means Washington may be a little different in terms of the presence of the market and access and availability. And that may have affected some of what we're seeing in terms of public health outcomes too. So one very positive story I wanted to share with you right off the bat is a story about a regulatory approach to child-resistant packaging that was implemented in Washington State. So I think some of you may recall that in 2017, there were concerns about child exposures, poisonings that were being reported to the Washington Poison Center from especially kids getting into edibles, cannabis edibles packaging. So the Washington Liquor and Cannabis Board acted to require a single-serve wrapping for edible packages and then to have a label with the Poison Center phone number on the edibles packaging. So on the right side of the screen, you can see this is an example of a Washington State product. You can see through the clear plastic outside that each of the gummies within is included, is individually wrapped. So if a young child gets into this package, they not only have to get into the overall packaging, but they have to get into each individual package per gummy. You can also see a little explosion of the label that's put onto every edibles packaging, and it does include the Poison Center phone number on there as well. So to understand whether this had an effect, we use what's called a difference in difference method to look at poisonings that were reported to U.S. poison control centers. And we looked at Washington State and other states before and after Washington State's policy change. And what we found was that this change in the packaging rules in Washington State was associated with a 25% reduction in edible poisoning reports for children under 10, a 51% reduction for ages 10 to 20, and a 23% reduction for adults 55 and older relative to the pre-policy period and relative to what we would have expected based on what we saw in other states. So it's a really positive story about how a regulatory change in Washington really had an impact on public health and safety. Here's another one. Dave talked a lot about advertising, and I'm just so curious to talk more about that. But one of the things that we know is that when cannabis retailers and advertising are available in communities, we know that that can be very visible, especially to young people. Washington State didn't have any kind of way to know the prevalence of young people that were being exposed to cannabis advertising. But in Oregon, in 2017, we added a question about this to our youth survey data, similar to the Washington State Healthy Youth Survey, but in Oregon. And I suspect that Washington kids would have looked the same at that period of time. And in Oregon, what we saw was that 72% of eighth graders and 78% of 11th grade students said they saw cannabis ads in their neighborhoods in that year. And among kids who had a cannabis retailer within a mile of their school, 85% of eighth graders and 87% of 11th grade students were seeing cannabis ads in their community. So this having cannabis legalization and cannabis advertising in communities definitely resulted in a lot of young people seeing these ads. So Washington State, as you may recall, was getting some input from the public about the advertising that was appearing in communities, and what, and Washington acted to change the rules about what was allowed. And so what you see below on the screen are examples of two ads that were in Washington in 2017, which both of which, or sorry, they're in 2016, and both of these types of ads would now be prohibited. So the sign waving, the guy waving the weed sign in front of the Burger King, which was from Thurston County, Washington, and then the billboard, the I'm so high right now, those would both not be allowed today, thanks to the change in advertising content restrictions that was applied by the LCB. So that's another positive story. So now let's talk a little bit about trends in cannabis use. And Dave just showed us some really elegant data about this. I'm going to show you the data from within Washington State, which largely tells the same story as Dave mentioned. So I'll show you adult data from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. That's our state's primary source of health behavior data among adults. And then from Washington State's Healthy Youth Survey, which is our state's primary source of information about health behaviors among kids. So first, this is cannabis use in the past 30 days, so what we categorize as current use among Washington State adults from 2012, when legalization first passed, through 2021. That's actually quite a new data point, so this might be new information, even if you follow the BRFIS pretty closely. The blue line is the percent of adults who used cannabis in the past 30 days. That went up from 8% in 2012 up to 17% in 2019. The question wasn't included in the survey in 2020. And then we just have this new data point from 2021 that looks the same as 2019. So looks like it's increased over time and then maybe leveling off a little bit in recent years. The orange line is the one that's a little bit more concerning. So this is the daily or near daily use, or 20 or more of the past 30 days. That's increased from 3% in 2012 up to 7% in 2019, and then 8% in 2021. So again, it looks like it may be stabilizing, but that has also increased. So that was any type of product use, but what about the specific types of products that people are using? And Dave mentioned that many people use multiple different types of products, we know from that survey. So we asked adults who currently use cannabis, what type of cannabis product did you use when you used it? And they could select as many as applied. And what you're seeing here now is the trend between 2015 and then through 2021, again, brand new data, about what kinds of products people are using. The top one is smoking cannabis products. So that has declined significantly from 85% in 2015 down to 70% in 2019, and then down now to 65% in 2021. And then on the flip side, we are seeing increasing use of some of these higher THC products. So the orange line is edible consumption that went up from 27% to 35% and now 46% in the brand new 2021 data. Vaping, interesting pattern, went up from 17%, then went up to 27% in 2019, but now has declined to 20% in 2021. And as Dave reminded us, we had the Avali outbreak at the end of 2019, so this might have affected people's use of vaping products. Maybe they're remembering that. And similarly, dabbing did look like it was sort of holding steady and maybe it's dropped a bit. And drinking sodas or teas that are infused with cannabis has remained sort of stable and low.
Dr. Julie, I have a question about that last slide.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts, or is there enough data? I'm thinking from a harm perspective approach. Are there any of these, like when I look at less people are smoking it? Well, is that a good, maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. Is there enough research to show, you know, are any of these methods of use better than others, if you will, from a harm perspective?
I think there's been a lot of recent discussion, as you know, about THC concentration and how that may affect the risk profile of different products. I think it's just different. And I think it probably, you know, smoking anything is probably not good for your lungs. And I think we're concerned about people inhaling any kind of combusted products and all the things that go with that. I think edibles, though, you know, can have specific risks associated with them. And maybe that those risks depend on how the quality of the products, you know, whether they're contaminated with any sort of adulterants, or, and the same could be said for vaporizing. So I guess the bottom line is, I think it all depends. I think there are probably different risk profiles, and I think we're learning more and more about that. But I don't have a specific answer.
Great, thank you.
So that was adults. Now let's look at young people. So here you're looking at current cannabis use, so any use in the past 30 days among Washington's youth for 12th grade, 10th grade, and 8th grade. From 2012 to 2018, it may be reduced a little bit or kind of stayed steady. In 2021, I have that dot disconnected from the prior trend line because we had a pretty substantial change in the way that the Healthy Youth Survey was implemented. We did see these dramatic declines relative to 2018. So for example, in 12th grade, among 12th graders, we had 26% of youth in 2018 who had used cannabis in the past 30 days, down to 16% in 2021. So that's a big drop. But some of that may be related to, you know, sort of post-pandemic school context effects and to the change in the survey administration. So so I don't think that means, I think just be cautious about interpreting that as a big drop. But overall, we didn't see those dramatic inclines that I think we, including me, worried about when cannabis was legalized. We haven't seen that broadly at the state level, but we have seen increases in some groups. And I just want to note, for example, I was part of a study that looked at youth who were working in part-time jobs. We measured increases in those older youth, those 12th grade youth who were working part-time jobs. And then also some new research from our team is showing that youth who have a cannabis retailer near their school are more, they're showing reductions in prevention indicators and increases in cannabis use indicators. So I think we have some work to do digging down underneath the surface of what these trends look like, but at least at the state level, they didn't do what we worried that they would do. But again, just like we talked about with adults, what kind of products are they using? Let's think about that with kids. So for the Healthy Youth Survey from 2014 to 2018, we asked kids who used cannabis products, what type of cannabis products are you using? But we forced them to choose one answer, their usual way of using. So, and we know that kids and others use a lot of different types of products, so this is a sort of a limited view. But what you can see, just like we saw with the adults, is that the blue line on the top is the percentage of current cannabis using students who said they smoked it, and that has declined over time from 2014 down to 2018. And then you see this kind of complementary increase in these higher THC products, the edibles and vapes to some extent, and then we added dabs in 2018. And so that's gaining a share of those kids. But then in 2021, we changed the question on the Healthy Youth Survey to instead ask the same question, but allow kids to select all that applied. So what were all the ways that you used it in the past 30 days? So among those students who used cannabis in the past 30 days, and here I'm showing you 10th graders, 67% had smoked it, half had vaporized, 51%, and then about a third, 32% used edibles, and about a third, 33% had dabbed it. So that's a big percentage of kids using cannabis who are using it, using some of these higher THC products.
Dr. Lee, I think that's a little different than what we saw in some of Dr. Hammond's, although I guess we didn't have the youth breakdown, but why do you think, I'm having a hard time reading all that, the vaping is so much higher for this group of 10th graders? Because if you looked at what we just looked at with Dr. Hammond, the legal market, the over 21 people, aren't vaping that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we saw that, so a couple of slides ago, among the adults, we also saw this decline in vaporized product use among adults using cannabis. So I'm actually a little surprised to look at it and see this for kids. All I can say is there may be reasons why kids prefer vaping products. You know, maybe that it's easier to conceal. There's certainly been a lot of use of e-cigarette nicotine products, so maybe there's sort of a transfer of the, you know, kids are comfortable with that type of product, and so it's easier for them to use. And maybe kids aren't paying, you know, to a 10th grader in 2021, they may not have all that much recall about the E-Volley outbreak that we were very excited about in 2019, because they were 8th graders and maybe they weren't paying attention. So their fear or concern about vaping product safety might not be as great as for adults.
Thank you.
I'll just end here with a few thoughts on other cannabis-related public health and safety measures. So these are a few just spotlights from some of our ongoing research. So emergency department visits, we did see increases in Medicaid enrollees, cannabis-related visits during 2006 up to 2015, and we saw the biggest increases in 2014 to 2015. Then we looked at hospitalizations. We've also seen increases in hospitalizations overall. And I should say for both hospitalizations and emergency department visits, some of that could be due to better documentation of, you know, people feeling more comfortable disclosing their cannabis use, and then it shows up in the record compared to when cannabis was illegal. But I think with hospitalizations in particular, one of the things I'm concerned about is that among people who are hospitalized with a cannabis-related code, we're seeing a greater share of those folks who are older adults, so ages 51 and older. That percentage changed from 2% of all cannabis-related hospitalizations being older adults in 1998 up to 33% in 2014 and the next couple of years. So so I think older adults are also a population that we need to be concerned about. I'm going to skip over treatment admissions and traffic crashes. These are both areas we're continuing to work on, and we're seeing sort of mixed results. So I'll skip that over. So in conclusion, we've seen that cannabis regulations that LCB applied that prioritize public health and safety, they really have had an effect in mitigating harms. So I'm proud of the work that's been done in regulatory approaches to prioritize public health and safety. We've seen adult use has increased overall, including frequent use. We've seen youth use has not increased overall, but we did see some suggestion of that in specific subpopulations. And we do see some examples of potential challenges ahead, including specifically looking at these products that are coming onto the market and the increased use of these products, especially with higher THC concentration, and as Jim said, maybe different risk profiles for some of those products, and then addressing risks in identified for specific populations. So maybe youth who live close to cannabis retail outlets for a couple of reasons, and maybe older adults is another population of growing concern for our study team. And that is it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And thank you both again. We've got some time here for more questions. I'll look to my colleagues first. Jim, Ollie, anything?
Yeah, I have a quick question. And so this could be for either one of you, but going back to the slide that we saw, Dr. Dilley, with the showing that there has not been an increase in youth use in Washington State, I'm wondering how Washington State compares across U.S., internationally. Are we also seeing that same trend, or is it a specific policy decision that we made in Washington State that we should be drilling down into and seeing if that was help with that? So that's my first question.
So among youth, I'll say that the first four states, some of us EPI folks from the first four states had collaborated to look at all of our youth data together. And we did see sort of the same thing in terms of like broadly, not huge increases. I will say one thing I didn't talk about today is all of us across all the states did see increases in cannabis use among older girls. So 12th grade girls, 11th grade girls in Oregon. That was a unique pattern among kids. And we saw that across all the states. We saw it in Alaska and Oregon and Colorado. So that is something I've been real concerned about. I do feel like we have a paper coming out looking at that, but I think just across the board, that story was pretty consistent across the states.
I'll just add, in Canada, we've seen basically no change. You know, the problems with this, of course, is there's secular changes outside legalization. So we started to bump up just in the year or two before legalization, but it's been pretty consistent in the 4 years since among young people. Our survey, my survey isn't the best because we don't have huge sample sizes among kids, but that's our government surveillance surveys. And, you know, so I think it's a consistent message that we've seen with some of the more mature legal US markets. Of course, you know, some of these things, you need to measure them in generations. You know, tobacco advertising is a great, you really need those kids to grow up potentially with promotional images for some time and then age into the period of initiation before you can really pass judgment. But so far it's been, you know, encouraging, I'd say.
Right.
Yeah, that's something I wonder about longer term. You know, when we were talking about, you know, use just grew as people got used to a legalized market and more people would see a store and it just becomes a little more socially acceptable. You know, we legalized it past 2012. But if you were born in 2012, cannabis is legal your entire life. Mm-hmm. Do you think we will see faster uptake of that generation when they hit 21? Are more of those people going to go and buy cannabis?
I mean, that's a brilliant question. I've got a lot of gray hair from testifying against tobacco companies in legal challenges to advertising laws. And that is the right timeline to think about. It's plausible. suggestion. I mean, that's why we call it promotional messaging. I suspect it will come down to, won't just be whether you have a legal market or not, it'll come down to the strength of the regulation. So in Canada, there's provinces, in most places, we require that you can't see through the windows of stores. We have very strict rules about signage. Those will be some of the promotional messaging that young kids interact with or not on their way to the store or on their way to school or whatever it might be. So I suspect that it will be the nature of some of those regulations and not simply whether cannabis is legal or not. Look, it's the same thing with tobacco. It's true in Canada, it's true in the US. We still obviously have legal tobacco sales, but we have managed to protect young people from tobacco marketing infinitely better than we did 50, 60 years ago. So I hope we're not having the same conversation we had for tobacco in 20 or 30 years from now. And but I'd say that there's pretty good evidence of that to date.
I'll just chime in. Yeah, I'll chime in. And this speaks back to Jim's question, too, about different state frameworks. So I mentioned that prevalence of youth cannabis use hasn't looked super different across states. But one thing we have looked at is some of those prevention indicators. So whether kids perceive that their parents believe it's wrong for a young person to use, whether they think their friends think it's wrong, whether they think adults in their community think it's wrong, those indicators look better in Washington state relative to Oregon. We did some state-by-state comparison and we looked at the regulatory frameworks. I would characterize how we did it, based on how we did it, I would characterize Washington's cannabis regulatory framework as more prevention supportive. And we saw better outcomes among those early prevention indicators among eighth graders in Washington relative to eighth graders in Oregon. So kind of speaking to what Dave said, like, so that's pretty far upstream, but when those eighth graders become 10th graders, become 12th graders, become young adults, that'll be when we know how this plays out across the generation.
I have a quick question. I appreciate you sharing specific positive results as a result of policy decisions that were made and positive outcomes. I really appreciate that. And I'm looking to see more of that in the future, where we're actually looking and measuring these policies and the decisions and impacts of these policies. Have either of you studied any specific where, in fact, we missed the mark? Are there things and policy decisions that we've made where you have done the research that shows that was not a good decision, in fact?
I have one thought, but Julie, did you want to go first? Or?
I see a little smile. I'm wondering if there's that.
Well, I mean, I do think that it's a little bit in the eye of the beholder. I will say this, and full disclosure, this is one of my little pet issues, but I think that we really haven't done much in terms of regulating the products themselves and people's understanding of the products. And from some of the data that I didn't show you today, we see, whether you're pro, anti, or whatever it might be, people have trouble dosing. Many cannabis consumers don't know how much to take. They have trouble when they go to a different product form. It's especially true of naive or new consumers. And so we've done a lot of the regulatory bits, but, you know, this reminds me of when we used to put tar numbers on cigarette packages or when we put nutrient amounts on food packages. Oh, it's legit, and there's a basis for that number, but consumers don't know how to use them. And so I think, and I actually point, you know, there's a lot of talk about standardized THC units and trying to help people to understand serving sizes. And by the way, what was done to what Julie referred to in terms of your packaging and labeling, you might know in Canada, the entire package of edibles can only include 10 milligrams of THC. But what it does is it provides consumers with some guidance. Now, 10 milligrams is still a decent amount it's a lot for a naive consumer to take. But I think we can do a better job, and this should be agreement because it helps the industry, it helps regulators, it helps consumers, help people to understand THC better and how it's present in the product in different forms. And that probably comes down to packaging and labeling and some other educational materials, because there's too many avoidable. We think about kids and accidental consumption. We think about edibles, but I have a slide that shows there's just as many or more adverse events from dried flower And in fact, it's very similar across different product forms. We're concerned about edibles because kids will pick it up and eat it, and that's a big concern. But many consumers have trouble dosing. So I think we can do better at helping them to understand that for a product. I say that's a good feature of a well-regulated market, whether you're talking about a pharmaceutical drug or alcohol or whatever it might be. I think we can improve. And I think that is a short step to your or someone's question about, well, which product form is the less harmful product? Okay, don't inhale. Well, that takes vaping off, but vaping's a little bit better than smoke. So we go with oral, but people have trouble dosing with oral oils, and then that brings us into edibles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you look at what Vermont's doing, what Connecticut's doing. I always say, look at the province of Quebec in Canada. They have the most strict regulations of any legal cannabis jurisdiction in the world. They have actually capped every product at 30% THC. They don't sell any wax or shatter above that. They've sold basically no vaping products. They've managed to see almost no change in or increase in consumption. Their illicit market isn't any bigger than other provinces. Now, I'm not saying this to say that we should start banning products. I'm just saying it's starting to ask the question of what I think of as like legalization 2.0. How can you help consumers to find their way to less harmful products and to take it in the way that suits their needs and minimizes their harm? And I think that's where we can do a lot better.
I think there's been, and we've talked about this with some other researchers who we've talked with at the board, but I think there's been some reluctance for what I think you've described as THC literacy, because it assumes it's okay to use this product. So some of the people that are most expert in that science don't necessarily want to help people learn how to do it responsibly. But I think in Washington, at least, we're to the point where we're cresting there, and I think we're going to get that kind of hopefully collaboration, because it's going to take the industry, the regulators, and the experts like yourselves to figure out what does that literacy look like with a goal of responsible users, not prohibition, but not promotion. And if either of you have any suggestions about how we start that process, you know, we've talked about bud tender training. You know, can you invest that responsibility in the people that are selling it behind the counter? I don't know.
Well, and I'm really interested in that senior population that was brought up. And, you know, I say it from the perspective of having two older parents, one living with dementia. And periodically, my dad will say things. My mom's the one living with dementia. Oh, I'm going to go to a pot store and get mom some pot. And I'm like, whoa, 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 let's talk about that. But I can see how important it would be for older adults to also get literacy around the various, you know, ways to use it and implications, et cetera.
But do you think that's starting to change? Because Dr. Dilley, when you showed that slide that mentioned the study of emergency room visits, and I remember when the stores first opened in the governor's office, what we heard right away was emergency room visits are up, and it's not kids, it's people that look like you, pointing to me and, you know, other people my age. Because they remembered what pot was like when they were a kid, you know, and they'd buy ditch weed for $10, you know. But isn't there at least that literacy does seem to have changed? People do at least anecdotally talk about often it's different today. Are we doing that naturally? Learning?
I think there is some of that happening naturally. I've looked more closely at kind of triangulating emergency department visits and hospitalizations and poison center calls in Oregon, because we had some, it's sort of a more phased in market opening. And I feel like we really did see sort of this, or like a spike in, especially among middle-aged or older adults. And I feel like that was that group of naive users who were interested in trying again and got surprised because things were different than they remembered. And then they, you know, made whatever change they needed to so that they didn't end up back in the emergency room or the calling the poison center. So I do feel like we saw sort of that group. They've learned and they've gone onward. So I think there's some of that, but I really agree. And I just so agree with what Dave said about the market. The products just continue to evolve so rapidly. And I mean, I study this and I can't keep up with what's going on. And I just, you know, I can only imagine how difficult it is for a user, especially a naive user.
And maybe I could just add one quick thought on that. I think the key here is that, look, obviously this is a legacy of not of having an illegal market, not having it be regulated, but we are seeing the transition of the cannabis market go into, I think, of food, more highly processed products, more manufactured. That's a function of legalization. You have industry, they offer different products. We've seen it in 10 years of Washington, in the last 4 years of our study, it will continue to go towards more processed products. There's a reason why most smokers, tobacco smokers in the US, don't roll their own cigarettes. We are going to see more pre-rolled cigarettes, cannabis joints. So, and the more processed the product is, the fewer cues there are to infer strength. So it's, you know, the comparison of like, when I smoked a joint in the 1970s, well, you can only get yourself in so much trouble smoking a joint. The problem is with edibles and oils and these other things where there are no physiological cues as you're ingesting it as to how strong it is. And there are huge ranges, you know, vaping products, they will run from 0 to 1 to 2%, up to 90% THC. There's, if you don't understand the number, you can't tell by the taste. So I think it's inevitable that we have to help consumers. I really like the idea of trying to get the retailers and bud tenders involved. But, you know, I don't know if it's like this in Washington State, but you walk in there now and they're still telling me, do you want sativa, indica? What kind of night do you want to have? Look, that's fine. There's room for that. But there's also room for knowing whether something is 5% or 50% or 20%, because that's what's going to get me in trouble or not. And so that's why I sort of think of labeling and making sure that there's some scientific basis for this. You don't have to push out the, it's like wine, you don't have to, you can still talk about what it's paired with and the palate and all that, but you got to make sure that people know that they're drinking a glass of wine versus a glass of vodka. And we haven't achieved that, I think, quite yet. And I think that labeling and packaging is an excellent opportunity for enhancing that.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think you're right. I'd love to see the industry work with public health to have an education program, and we should look for how to incentivize that among people. Thank you both. It was fascinating. I was really glad to see that Mary had scheduled this for us all. I think the news generally is fairly positive. I'm glad to see Washington is doing better in a lot of these really important ways than some other states, and that some of the worst case hasn't come true. But obviously there's work to do, and we know that as the market evolves, our challenges will evolve. So appreciate your input. Mary, I will turn it back over to you to wrap us up if I could.
All right. Thank you, Chair Postman. Thank you to Dr. Dilley, Dr. Hammond. This is just a wealth of information. We know that you have more available, that you've really just kind of covered the top layer, and we'll look forward to digging more deeply into this. It really emphasizes the importance of research and that we use it to inform our policy and educational efforts. There's a lot to unpack. Some things that I pulled out of today's presentation as we look forward, that we need to look more closely at our medical patients' needs and how those might be better met. We need to continue to assess our advertising, especially its impact on youth. And as we talked in detail, the packaging and labeling, we need to better understand the effectiveness of our warning statements and especially serving size. And how do we convey that information in better ways? Some of this is regulation. Some of this is our focus on more education efforts, understanding THC concentration. I think one thing we didn't really talk very much about was the influx of hemp-derived products and how little we know about those because they don't fall under current regulation, and we're seeing that our consumers don't necessarily understand the difference in these products. We need to continue to keep an eye on trends, what's increasing, what's decreasing, continue to track all of this, and where possible, support the research that we can have to better inform policy and protect public health. And I think all of the information today helps bring that into focus. So again, thank you to the board and thank you to our presenters. And I look forward to continuing further discussions on these topics.
Great. Thank you, Mary. Yeah, thank you both. I just thought of some more questions, so I'll be emailing you both. appreciate the work you're doing every day. That's great. And thank you, Mary. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we will move to our next item, which is board meeting prep and a rules update. Kathy and Jeff. Hello, morning.
Good morning, Chair Postman, board members Garrett and Vollendroth.
Morning.
I'm going to start this morning with just a quick update on the monthly rules update, and it's pretty brief this morning because of the staffing reduction that we just had. Happy to say that I think we have two new people joining us, and I'll be able to share a little more information on that in the coming weeks. So very quickly, there's really no updates to offer on the alcohol rules at this point, although I've been taking care of providing recommendations or working on recommendations regarding a rule petition we received in mid-October asking the agency to consider rulemaking that would allow a Class 13 alcohol server permit holder to engage in the same activities that a Class 12 alcohol server permit holder engages in. And so I'll bring a recommendation to you on that in early December, or one of our most new rules coordinators might do that as well. And then moving on to cannabis, Jeff will be offering a recommendation on cannabis related rule petition tomorrow, and is working on the response to another cannabis related rule petition we received in the middle of last month. So more to come there. So with respect to the canopy rule project, we moved our second World Cafe to November 29th. We planned on having it in mid-November, but moving it out for a variety of reasons, primarily based on the amount of material that we culled or harvested from the first World Cafe. Still working on the thematic analysis there. So we did move that back until November 29th, so more information coming on that. And then also Jeff and I are working on new work groups. Last week, Jeff announced that he will be leading the work group for evaluation of the effectiveness of the cannabis quality control rules that went into effect last April. He will be accepting applications for that group through November 23rd, and we've received quite a number of applications already. And then with respect to the cannabinoid science work group that I'll be chairing, I do anticipate sending out our first agenda in the next couple of weeks, list of work group members and meeting information. And so both of these work groups will be open to the public to listen in, although we haven't really worked out the parameters of what the public interaction will be. I suspect there will be some interaction at the end of the meeting, but truly it is sort of a listening style until the very end of the meeting on those, as I think the way that we're putting them together. And then we'll have information on that on the policy and rules website in the future. And then moving into cannabis advertising, of course, that project is on pause until we're fully staffed again. Wanted to share also, we had hoped to bring the CR 101 on cannabis sampling to you during this meeting today, but we're pausing that just based on staffing at this point. And
I'm sorry, I missed what you said. What were you going to bring to us?
Cannabis sampling. We had sampling. Hoped to bring
Thank
that.
You. Yeah.
Yeah, we had hoped to. That was a rule petition that we accepted a couple months ago. We had hoped to move that forward, but we're going to have to pause until we're fully staffed to bring that forward. So any questions on the rule update? It really is brief this month. No questions? Okay.
No questions.
All right. So I'll go ahead and move into board prep. And first thing I'll start with is the 103 that I'll be providing to you tomorrow for consideration of adoption. And that was the project that Audrey put forward in an expedited process to make limited technical changes to rules. And those were just specifically address changes. So physical address changes, and then references to email addresses in our rule. No comments were received, so no changes from the 105 or the expedited form to the package that I'll be bringing to you tomorrow. So if adopted, the rules will become effective 31 days after filing around December 11th, 2022. So any questions on that? No, pretty straightforward. Okay. And then moving into the rescissions, the first will be actually a rescission that will be followed by the filing of a policy statement, and that had to do with Board Interim Policy 1, 2020 regarding frozen alcohol popsicles. This is something that we'd like to move to rulemaking in the future, but in keeping with our sort of moving away from Board Interim Policies, we're asking that this be rescinded tomorrow, and then I will immediately file a policy statement with the Code Revisor's Office and put that on our website. So the only change is just conversion to a policy statement. So any questions on that?
I just would make a quick comment if I can. You know, this, sure. This was before us a while ago, and I asked to postpone it because I wanted to learn more about these frozen popsicles and things and what the policy did. And we can talk more about it tomorrow. But basically, what I have come to understand, and I think this is right, you know, the conversion of interim policies to policy statements is just good governing in general. And as Kathy was saying, we've done a lot of it. We're almost done. Eliminating the policy statement makes it more wide open for these sorts of products. It's not stopping those products. So what the policy statement did, I mean, the board interim policy did, was set up some guidelines for the retail sale of these products. We're now going to move it into a more formal process, but what we're doing is we're keeping in place what restrictions there are. Do I have that right,
That's
Kathy?
Right. And it's for the labeling specifically, so we can take a look at the label and make sure that under the guidelines or guardrails that were expressed in the board interim policy and now hopefully the policy statement, that we'll be able to take a closer look at those products to make sure that they don't resemble products that might be considered to be especially appealing to persons under 21. And what we were seeing before were there were some products that resembled things like Otter Pops or Push Pops with bright colors and cartoon characters and those sorts of things. And this gave us a way to take a closer look at those products and then ask people to downshift or make the products less appealing. And then we could take another look at the packaging through a review process that's spelled out in the board interim policy.
Yeah, I'm a policy skeptic, I would just say that. So, but yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, any questions on that other than Chair Postman's?
No.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Next is a request, or tomorrow I will be requesting your approval to rescind Board Interim Policy 12-2019 that had to do with cannabinoid additives. This is kind of a complicated interim policy, but current statute provides that licensed cannabis processors and producers can purchase CBD outsourced, you know, outsourced that from the I-502 system and bring it into the system only for the purposes of enhancing cannabidiol concentration in a licensed product. So that's the only way that you can bring outsourced CBD. So CBD that wasn't produced within the I-502 system, that's the only way you can bring it in. And so I think it was in 2018, we promulgated rules that pretty much mirrored that statute, and that for the record is RCW 695326. But the rules were promulgated at a time that we were using the LEAF system. And our LEAF traceability system didn't have a way to track products that were outsourced or produced outside the I-502 system. So this board interim policy allowed for that process to happen, but our rule said that they had to report those outsourced products to LEAF. So time passed, now we have CCRS. CCRS is capable of tracking these products. And for that reason, since LEAF has been retired, and we do use the CCRS system, this board interim policy is no longer necessary. So I'll ask for its rescission tomorrow. Any questions on that? It's kind of
no question.
A little bit complicated. Well, good. I'm glad to hear it.
You did a great job of explaining it. That's why there's no questions. Thank you.
Good to hear. I appreciate it. Okay, and so with that, that's all I will be presenting tomorrow. I would like to pass it over to Jeff to give you a briefing on the recommendation that he will be presenting on the rule petition. So go ahead, Jeff.
No, thank you, Kathy. Good morning, Chair Postman and board members Garrett and Vollendorf. At tomorrow's meeting, I will be presenting the agency response to a rulemaking petition that we received from John Kingsbury on September 29th. This petition asks the agency to create a new administrative rule to require I-502 licensed cannabis retail stores to receive the consent of customers before electronically storing any of their personal information. And Mr. Kingsbury indicates specifically for marketing purposes. His petition also asks for confidentiality of patient medical recognition card information. And in reviewing the petition, because cannabis is an age-restricted product, cannabis retail stores must, by law, be able to verify that all customers are at least 21 years of age. And some cannabis stores have followed the practice that other retailers are using now of using an electronic point of sale system to scan customers' ID to confirm that the card is was issued to someone who was 21. So, Mr. Kingsbury's petition is asking for a rule that addresses how that information is held or retained by the retailer. So this petition also asks for special confidential treatment of information from patient medical recognition cards. And as I will explain in the petition response tomorrow, the information on the medical recognition cards is covered and protected already under DOH rules. So that's something that I'll talk about tomorrow. So in summary, that's the gist of the petition. There are some other requests to have enhanced signage and policies, privacy information available at the cannabis stores. So that's all I have to present today. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there, you and I talked about this one earlier, but I can't remember. Are there state laws governing today retailers' use of such information across the board in any way, or who does regulate? Is that a federal regulation, or is there none?
Well, as far as I know, there isn't any regulation that in state law that specifically addresses that retention of customer information. There is an RCW though that lays out reporting requirements when there's a breach of customer information. Say a business had a hacking incident or something like that. You know, we're all familiar with these large data breaches that happen to large retail stores. And there is an RCW that does address those reporting requirements. It's RCW 19 255010. And that's the limit of the laws I was able to find in my research.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Jeff, I have a quick question, and sure. We talked a little bit about this, but I just want to make sure that I am remembering this right. And that is, do we have reason to believe that, in fact, a retailer who is scanning somebody's license for the sole purpose of determining their age appropriateness to purchase product, that they're, in fact, using that information for purposes of advertising at all? Do we have any information about that?
No, I don't have any information or any evidence of that. It may be happening depending on the sophistication of the point of sale system, if it's able to track customer information, but it's not clear exactly what is what each retailer is accessing when they scan the card.
Thank you.
It's a good question, though. We should ask some retailers if those systems even retain that information.
That's what I was wondering. If it, in fact, if they even have the ability to.
In my research, I found some descriptions of systems that provide a kind of an enhanced verification environment that is, I guess, probably proprietary, you know, based on other data sources that the point of sale system has access to. But I think some of them, and probably I would think many of them, are only set up just to provide a simple yes no verification.
Well, we hear this on the alcohol side in the grocery stores when people don't want their ID scanned, and it's my understanding that that's transitory data and that there's no storing of that data at that point. And so I'm assuming that's true for cannabis retailers as well, that it's transitory data and that it's not stored anywhere for use in any other way. But I don't know that, in fact, to be 100% true.
Yeah, and you know, I believe that probably most of it is transitory data, or maybe because it's just a simple check to verify age. Age is the only limiting factor for an ID check for our cannabis store. There's no other identification requirement. So, you know,
though, you know, Jeff, you do mention the big breaches we're all aware of, and I will say, if there is information, probably possible for someone to both retain, collect, and somebody else to breach it. So I understand the concern for sure, but I think you got the right approach here, so I appreciate that. Okay, thanks, Jeff, appreciate it. See you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Anything other, Kathy, on your guest list?
That is it, thank you very much.
Okay, great, thank you. We'll see you tomorrow too. Any board member reports, members?
I have nothing today. Thank you.
Gretchen, anything?
No, I have nothing. Thanks.
You can just shake your head or nod your head. Okay, thank you. I do feel confident to say that I will see you all tomorrow for a board meeting and EMT tomorrow afternoon, executive management team meeting tomorrow afternoon. So a couple of opportunities. Thanks again to Drs. Dillian Hammond and to Mary Sagawa for bringing those folks together. That's really interesting. I'm kind of excited about some of what we heard. So I think we'll do some good follow-up. Okay, great. See you all tomorrow. Have a great day.
All right, thanks, David. David, and you'll see me in person tomorrow, by the way, so I'll see you then.
Really? Wow. I'm going to get dressed up. Okay.
See you
then. See you then.